G'day everyone and welcome to TYT Interviews. Well, as you know, the United States remains the only nation on earth not a part of the Paris Climate Accord. Our President Donald Trump thinks that global warming was created by China to make US manufacturing less competitive. And just this week, the EPA, or Environmental Protection Agency, said they weren't even sure if they were allowed to use the word climate. So I brought onto the show someone who definitely is allowed to use the word climate, Andrew Revkin. Welcome to the show.
Great to be here.
Now, you've been writing about climate slash global warming for over 30 years. I have a 1988 edition where you're talking about the greenhouse effect.
Yeah, I found it on eBay recently.
You bought your
exciting.
Own work.
Yeah.
But you've also been writing for the New York Times. You wrote for the New York Times for 21 years. You're now the strategic advisor for science and environmental journalism at the National Geographic Society.
Yeah.
So a long career talking about climate change.
Indeed.
So I want to ask you, of all the 30 years you've reported on climate under many different presidents, where does this year rank on the scale of optimistic to pessimistic?
Well, in a weird way, and I wrote about this when I was briefly at ProPublica in the middle of all that. Trump is, he's doing a lot of damage to regulatory institutions like the EPA, but the climate problem, here's the weird thing, the climate problem is so big that it seems to mostly defy presidents' interests, whether they're in the interest of doing something more or doing something less. If you look at trajectories for emissions, and even for basic science research, and I wrote a piece 10 years ago, 2006, more than 10 years ago, on declining R&D budgets, basic science budgets for energy, right in a time when, if you look through time, you'll see that's a bipartisan sort of slumber party.
Science has been going down.
Yeah, on energy, on the basic things you would need to do if you really want to address this problem in an aggressive way, there's very little sign that we take it seriously, especially when you compare that R&D investment to the R&D we put into defense, like making better weapons or, better cyber stuff. It's energy research is like this, and defense research is like this.
It's way higher. I want to challenge you on that, though, yeah. Because President Barack Obama said that climate change was the greatest threat. Well, he said there's no threat that's a greater threat than climate change, and yet only 20 to 45%, less than half of the United States, depending on which surveys you look at, say that they're actually worried about climate change. 50% of the United States population don't even believe that we're causing climate change. So why should we be investing more than we are? Like, everyone's worried about terrorism. Why should we be investing in climate?
I mean, right, if you take it as if public interest should drive our decisions on how we spend taxpayer money, absolutely. And by the way, that's after 30 years of me telling the world through various ways this is something that's important. It's not just presidents, but the journalists, the graybeards, have been at this for a long time. And then we've won awards and done cover stories and stuff. And I learned along the way that again, this is sort of bigger than I grew up. When I grew up in the 20th century, environmental problems had a certain character. You identify the problem, the ozone layer, or conventional pollution from smokestacks, and you pass a law and it goes away. And I started to realize that the climate problem is, again, it's got these dimensions that are way bigger than that. And if you just look at the curve for carbon dioxide, the main emission, and you focus on it, you say, wow, this is terrible. And it's heading in a direction that's going to be really bad for the world in the long haul. But then you look at every other curve, and they all have the same shape, phosphorus, nitrogen. We're in the middle of a big surge of our potency as a species that's way beyond this thing called CO2 and climate. And that's why I think when you start to appreciate that scope, it's like, this is something bigger than just a simple regulatory solution. And that's why it's defied most presidents, most media, and that there are other reasons, of course, as well.
Do you think they just don't know what to do about it? It's just too hard?
I think, one of my liberating moments came when I realized when something is that big and complex, climate change is basically everything. It's not just CO2 in the atmosphere. It's changing the oceans. The solutions are not just about technology. The transitions in energy systems take a long time. When you look at something and realize it's that big, you can either get really bummed out and paralyzed, or you can sort of say, well, where's my piece of it? Mm. And look at your own skill sets, whether you're young and still have your career ahead of you, or whether you're older and, you know, can make some choices about how to maximize the output from the latter part of your career. And yeah, that's kind of sort of where I am. Although, you know, I'm hoping the latter part means decades to come, but
so do I.
Yeah, well, you know, and then moving toward at National Geographic Society, for example, I'm helping build a mechanism for supporting a lot more communication innovation in service of sustainability issues, including climate change. And that, and not just journalism, you know, anyone can communicate now in a way that was impossible. It used to be, again, in the 20th century, I grew up with this guy named Walter Cronkite, you know, who basically said, that's the way it is. And you didn't have to, you know, you relied on these authority figures, or the page one of the New York Times, you know, or the Washington Post. And now, not only does the reader or viewer have to do more of the work, but the reader or the viewer can actually be a good communicator. So I'm about sort of expanding this definition of who gets to do the communication.
Who can talk about it.
You know, what can you do with your networks, whether you're a journalist or a citizen, from the local to whatever scale.
Now, you're hoping that you've got many decades ahead of you working on helping people to communicate, maybe one or two. Did you say just a few?
Well, I said maybe, at least a few.
Some years ahead. Yeah. But look, this has been 30 years you've been talking about this issue, and you know, I think probably less people believe in climate change in the United States today than they would have back in the 80s. Do you ever see covers like this from 30 years ago and think, man, I'm a failure?
Well, I've written about and spoken about my mistakes. They're not really mistakes, though. It's like...
Not to put all of climate change on
No. But what I learned, you know, it was like... So that was 1988. It was around 2006 when an editor first asked me, hey, why is there so much yelling about this issue? And can you do a piece for the Week in Review section at the time? So I wrote this piece, ended up on the headline, Yelling Fire on a Hot Planet. And it kind of got criticized by everybody, the left and the right, because it said, you know, if you just perceive this as a rhetorical fight between believers and skeptics, or whatever you want to call them, denier hadn't really become a big part of the conversation yet at that point. If you believe that, then what I was reporting in that piece would be really inconvenient, because what it said, I basically dug in on the behavioral science for the first time. You know, social sciences, I talked to a sociologist at UC Irvine, and Helen Ingram, I think was her name, and she said, well, the problems that bring people to a voting booth are things that are soon, salient, and certain. Mm-hmm. And I thought about that in the context of climate change, and it's like, oh my God. And
then, not soon, it's not salient.
Well, you know, aspects of it are real time, but the big impacts, you know, many feet of sea level rise are, you know, our kids' grandkids' generation will be the ones who will be in this kind of long slope toward lots of challenges. And then I interviewed Dan Kahane, a guy at Yale, who I'm sure you know, who brought me into the darkest terrain of all, which is this work he's done that he calls cultural cognition. There's a website, culturalcognition.net, and he's done empirical work that shows that that more science literacy actually doesn't. More science literacy is at the two ends of the spectrum of global warming concerns. Like, those who are completely dismissive and those who are completely worried are where you have the most literacy on, like, what's a greenhouse gas and all that stuff.
So there's people that really get the science but still really don't believe in climate change.
Yeah, and that's, you know, again, as a journalist, where you spend all your days thinking communicating science is the path to public, you know, momentum on an issue like that, and you realize, oh, this is bigger. As I said, it's not just bigger because it's, you know, we're in this big surge of resource appetites. It's also bigger because our behavioral norms, evolved to do very different things. They respond to immediate threats, and we're really bad at that stuff. And that was the scariest science of all.
So you could be the best communicator in the world, but because of human behavior, we might still never get there.
Unless you communicate that science too. Mm-hmm. Meaning, you know what, it's normal that you yell at someone who's in a different tribe than you. When an issue becomes tribal, which is, you know, abortion, gun rights, global warming, nuclear power, GMOs.
All the fun issues.
All the fun issues that are also very consequential ones. It's actually unremarkable that people would be divided. That also leads to opportunities too. There's absolutely messages from that science that say, well, if you maybe don't talk about global warming, because as there was a, there's a great CNN journalist who went to the most skeptical county in America on global warming in 2015, Woodward County, Oklahoma. John Sutter is his name.
The most skeptical of climate
most
change.
Most skeptical
Don't climate. Believe in climate change.
Yeah, and he went there and just did these simple interviews with people against a gray screen, you know, what do you think about this, that, and the other? And the first minute and a half, it's on YouTube, it's fantastic. The first minute and a half, if you're worried about climate change, you just want to kind of give up and jump off a cliff into the ocean or something. Because there's a woman, looks like a very nice woman. She says, you know, out here, Al Gore's name is like a cuss word.
Oh,
and then there's a guy who owns a local oil company, and he says, only God controls the environment. And so by a minute and a half, you're kind of like, okay. And then the second half, though, is the same guy, the blue shirt guy with the oil company guy, says, you know, we have solar panels on half of our roof, and I'm going to finish the job. We want to get off the grid entirely.
So and they're acting for sustainability, even though they hate the idea of climate change.
Well, and the great thing about that conversation is you realize here's a guy, his motivation to get off the grid is all about being a libertarian. He doesn't want anybody controlling his life, you know, whether it's Hillary Clinton or a utility. And so you would never convince him by sort of badgering with messaging about global warming that's the reason he should do this thing. In fact, one of the morals of that story to me is that not only would it not work, but it could be counterproductive because you're essentially painting him as the enemy. Mm-hmm. If you don't understand this issue the way I do, then why would he support, a subsidy for solar? You know,
so do you think that the solution then is to overcome this huge proportion of the population that don't believe in climate change, to just give up on trying to convince them, but convince them on something else? Like, we really need solar power for national defense, or we really need solar power for the American economy. Like, should we be just ignoring climate change and working on something else?
Well, no, I don't think it's that simple. But I do think, and this is kind of what I did in my own career when I moved into blogging, mm-hmm. you know, .earth, which I created in 2007. I tried to create it as a interrogatory, conversational relationship with people, a place to, you know, not every piece had this feel, but where I would test an issue, you know, some like Lester Brown on food and Vaclav Smil, great name, Manitoba, the genius, resource history genius on food. And one of them, Vaclav Smil, said, no, you can't talk to Lester Brown, he's nuts, you know, he's like, he's so extreme on these issues. Yes. And I said, well, Lester, he's part of the conversation, so can we find, I said, Vaclav, can we find some way to for you to respond to some of his thoughts and vice versa? And they didn't do it face-to-face, it wasn't like on a stage, that would have been great too. Because,
mm-hmm.
you know, human beings, the more human they are, the harder it is to, like,
to hate
just
them.
Sort of hate somebody. But so I got them as this sort of middle child, you know, let's find one thing you guys agree on. And this relates to climate change too, but it was that they both agreed that the middle class diet of 2050 will not resemble the middle class diet of today. That there's just no way to have that much meat and all that stuff. And I thought that was a great achievement. Just that one little. So what that means is my communication model moved way away from, you know, exposition, you know, telling you, here are things you need to learn about climate change, and here are, you know, the solutions to, so from communication to conversation.
Finding the things we can agree on and going
yeah.
from there.
And then conversation also has to have its own, you know, a lot of people, as I learned from someone recently, most people spend a conversation just waiting to make their point.
Yeah.
They're not actually listening. So finding ways to structure conversations that have real meaning, where people are really engaging on ideas as opposed to just sort of waiting to make their point and then to go on to the next one is important, and there's a skill set there. But not very, very little of that exists in our current media market.
Well, that's a really good point that you make, because it's sometimes hard to find something that we can all agree on, especially on a network like TYT Network, where I'm sure right now there's going to be comments from the trolls in the comments section, people saying that they don't believe in climate change and that you're a lefty and that you don't know what you're talking about and you've been sent here by China to make us less competitive. So when people are saying those sort of things, they're trolling climate communicators.
Yeah.
How do you find something in common with them?
It's hard, especially online, because it's so impersonal. It's so easy to spew. At Dot Earth, every comment that came in, I moderated, and it was just me. It was like a one-person little enterprise.
That would have been frustrating.
And I very rarely, cut them out. But part of what you have to do is sort of think of it like a playground, where you have the ideal playground is where you have clear rules and consistent enforcement, and an emphasis. But this only works if they're moderated comments. If it's just on, then that gets challenging. One thing I did on Dot Earth that I experimented with, we never moved forward with, and maybe Young Turks could do this. I found out that the code for our comments back then at the Times allowed you to embed a YouTube video. Mm-hmm. So I just said to my readers, hey, post a little video greeting to your other Dot Earth, passengers. And just so there was a humanization, because you see these comment threads and it's just text. And the first woman to do it was, her name was Wang Suya. She was in Tokyo. She's Chinese, but she was in Tokyo. And she posted the cutest comment. It basically said, hello, Dot Earth. I'm Wang Suya in Tokyo, and I'm very happy to be part of this Dot Earth community. And so I kind of thought of it like the old Harry Potter movies, where that newspaper, Daily Prophet, is sort of dynamic. And
you see the pitches moving.
Just humanizing things, again, kind of like what I was saying about, having a conversation with somebody is different than having a debate with somebody. And if you're just girded for debate, then it's hard. And all that takes work. Although YouTube comments don't take any work. They just make them go up unless they're,
Well, this can be part of the mission to civilize. If you're watching this interview and you'd like to leave a video message for us or any, a URL for us to look and put a face to your comments, please do. We would love to see them.
And it is a little bit like training a dog. I've learned to reward positive behavior, ignore negative behavior. It tends to lead people more to...
But it's so hard when people say they're
totally hard.
Yeah. Now, speaking of things that are difficult, you've got a brand new book out called Weather.
I do. Yeah.
It's a picture book. It's an illustrated history of weather. You've got nice, beautiful graphics in here. Why a picture book? You've had 3 decades of writing text. Did you switch to pictures because you realized we're just all too dumb to understand?
Well, it was the publisher had this idea. No. No. The publisher had this idea way back in 2012. Sterling, someone there, an editor, got in touch with me. They wanted me to write an Earth book, like the history of... This is 100 moments in the history of our relationship with climate and weather. And they wanted an Earth book that was like 250 moments. And I was like, that's way too much like work. That was 2012.
That's a lot of moments.
And they kind of circled back to me and said, well, we want to do a weather book. And they have like the engineering book, the law book, the medicine book. And it's sort of illustrated history of... an idea, disciplines and stuff. And I thought, finally, that's cool. I could do 100. And my wife got involved. She's an environmental
Your
educator.
Wife is Lisa. He's
Lisa
also one of the book, yeah.
And we
Husband
did it.
Husband and wife team.
And we were civil and didn't really end up throwing things at each other. And it became kind of an adventure. She found, and some of them are simple. And they're not all climate changes, blah, blah, blah. We have a lot. There's many items on the evolution of the idea and now the demonstrated reality of human-driven climate change, but there's also watermelon snow, which I never even
I didn't even get to that bit.
No, and it turns out in the 1800s, this explorer scientist saw pink snow in the Arctic, and he brought some back, and of course it was just became water. they didn't have a fridge, and a botanist, a Scottish botanist, I think, realized it was algae.
That was making it pink.
Yeah, and so that's in there too. And what I like about those kinds of stories is it's all about inquiry. Wow, what is that? It's about science. So they're not just, it's not like just it could have been a book of weather that's like the worst storm, the biggest, the hottest, blah, blah, blah. And it has a couple of those too, but it's about learning. And climate change is part of a much bigger learning curve that we are on and remain on. Geoengineering is one of these big frontiers coming up. Can we... artificially cool the climate to make up for what we're doing to it.
Probably the biggest puzzle of our time is how do we fix what we've done to the climate.
Yeah.
I want to challenge you on the title though, because it's called Weather, but you're a climate reporter, you've had a long history in climate change.
Mm-hmm.
Are we not confused enough about the difference between weather and climate? Why did you pick the name Weather and not climate change?
Well, on any particular day, it's the weather that matters. Climate is the average of weather conditions over a period of time. And it felt to me a little bit like a more of an open approach to get to readers who might immediately recoil, either because they think a book on climate is just woe is me, or because they have an ideological resistance. And to me, it was the importance of this journey there. It's like my journey as a journalist for 30 years. Basically, Lisa and I tell this, the big moment of the journey that we're on right now with climate change is 99.9% of the human journey has been a one-way street. Weather did, the climate system did stuff, a storm or a rising seas over a long period of time. Mm-hmm. And you either moved, died, or you know, adjusted. You put on clothes or moved into a cave.
We don't.
So it was one-way street. And now it's clear it's becoming a two-way relationship. And that's a big deal for a species. And it's only been like 50 years of really sort of a firm understanding of that. And that's in the in the history of human knowledge building, that's a microsecond. And then it's really important. The guy, 1896, Svante Arrhenius, this Swedish scientist who won the first Nobel Prize, he is the one who really articulated for the first time that if we burn a lot of coal, we're going to warm the climate.
When was that?
1896.
1896.
Yeah, but here's the
more than 100 years ago.
I know, but here's the interesting thing. At his time, the end of the 19th century, you know, we were all into progress and industrialization and cities and energy was a great thing, you know. And so his interpretation of that was that we were going to see more warmer climates would be a great world ahead for a long period of time. And that says to me an important thing, which is the kind of the cultural and historical context when an idea emerges really shapes
how we see it.
How we see it.
Yeah.
And when you think about global warming from greenhouse gases, again, it emerged right after we had passed the Clean Air Act. And we had solved the ozone depletion problem, the CFCs, with a treaty. So that's why everyone jumped on the idea that, well, we just need a new treaty.
Yeah.
You know, a new, or use the Clean Air Act to solve the climate problem. And it's so much bigger than that. It's a bad fit, but it's part of our mental construct.
We're like, it fixed the ozone, so it'll fix climate.
Oh, by the way, one of the most depressing things is one of the most misinterpreted realities still is that when you ask the average person about global warming, they think it's the ozone.
They still think it's the ozone problem.
Well, they and
did
of course,
such a good job.
And it's complicated. You know, they are kind of like, there are some aspects that are interrelated. So I don't know, it's just like a journey. And then...
You've got 100 moments in here.
Yeah.
Which one's your favorite?
The invention of the windshield wiper.
Why?
Well, it's one of my favorites. It was invented by a woman
in
1902 from Alabama, who was up north in the winter and saw a trolley car operator having a terrible time keeping his window clean. And she sketched out some how to have a reciprocating rubber thing going that way. And she worked with a guy back in Alabama. And the patent is beautiful. You know, Google has now Google Patents search, found the patent. It's written beautifully. And again, inquiry. She saw a problem. She was a citizen. An engineer, you know, she thought she could come up with a solution. It has a kind of a downside where she got, the patent was granted, but it expired in 1917, just before automobiles became a big deal.
Oh, no.
So she never
profited from that one.
But that's pretty cool. And right around the same time, the invention of air conditioning was probably one of the most momentous changes in our relationship with the climate.
Yeah.
Because remember, the book is about the relationship, not just, you know,
yeah,
findings.
The climate and responding
yeah,
to
Yeah, and that one's pretty cool too.
Now, my last question for you is, you're a musician.
I am.
What musical instruments can you play?
Guitar, banjo, mandolin, in that order, declining
scale.
And really bad fiddle. Like, that's like way down there.
And sometimes you sing about climate.
I do. I just did yesterday. Yeah, I don't have tons of environmental songs, but I wrote one called Liberated Carbon. It's a 3-minute history of our energy journey. And then another one called The Flood, about a flash flood in the Rockies in 1995. So that's a song about climate vulnerability. And yeah, I can't not, you know, to me, it's just part of being a multimedia storyteller. You know,
I think that's all
part of the...
You've had three decades of writing about climate.
Yeah.
Now you've got a picture book. Are you going to put out a kids album of climate now?
I haven't done a kids album yet. I do have a couple of kids stories I'm working on. But I just think, again, like I said about the climate problem more generally, I think anyone can find a way to get dug in on it. And whether you're a musician or an artist, there are these great sonifications of that term is, you know, how do you turn data into sound, of the climate problem. There's a cellist. He was a student at the University of Minnesota who was a cello student and I think in earth environmental science, and he created this wonderful piece. It's just historical record of temperature, right, for the last 150 years, but through a series of translating into notes on the cello. So it's kind of got this up, and then lots of variability, because, you know, climate has a huge amount of implicit natural variability, and our signal is this note that's kind of in the background. So I thought that was fantastic. Now, did it change anybody's views or whatever? I don't know yet, but some of that has to be kind of let go of, to the idea that someone, like, if we just do it this way, then we'll solve this problem.
Change their ideas.
And it's, again, it's going to take time. It'll actually take time. I mean, as I
even
said,
more than 30
well,
years.
Well, here's, so 30 years ago, a great science magazine made its money by selling tobacco ads. That says to me, wow, that's amazing that that happened at that time. Kind of like Arrhenius thinking CO2 was great. But it also means that things change. Yeah. You know, the norms of, what was that song? the norms of the 80s are not the norms of now. And that's there's hope in that, too.
So 30 years ago, Discover Magazine was selling tobacco on the back cover, but things have changed. Maybe 30 years from now, we're going to be looking back and saying, wow, remember when no one believed in climate change? That was a funny time, wasn't it?
I think there's some of that there. And enriched flavor, low tar, a solution with merit.
Well, anyway, no matter if you've got a music-loving family member that doesn't believe in climate change or a picture book-loving family member that doesn't believe in climate change, get yourself a copy of Weather. It's hopefully less confronting than a book called Climate, and learn a lot about our history of our interaction with the weather. It's a beautiful book. Gorgeous illustrations.
Well, thank you. And I'd love to hear other. I'd love to hear their favorite milestones. Everyone has an experience with weather that really jogged them, you know, everyone. And so I'd love to hear some of those too.
Well, today it's the first day of spring in New York City and snowing.
That's right.
So that's, I don't like the snow, but I'll endure it. So sometimes when I hear about climate change, I'm like, if only we could make it a little bit warmer and have a bit less snow, that would be all right. But it doesn't quite work that way, unfortunately, unlike what many senators might believe. Well, thank you so much for joining us on TYT Interviews, Andy.
Anytime.
And keep writing about climate change. One day we'll get there.